thanks very much. So I think on the schedule there's no question mark in the title of my talk. I thought it sounds less like a statement.
I thought that was his, not him.
I should say right away that this is a very non-technical talk, so it may be a bit boring for the specialists in category theory who may want to see a bit more what's actually going on. Just wanted to get somewhere and wanted to give an overview of the whole story. I decided to do it that way, and I can only ask you to ask some questions over lunch, or maybe there's some interest in the tutorial this afternoon. Okay, so let's get started, maybe with a small warning. I like this quote a lot. I also like the name of the guy, actually. So with this in mind, can you see it? Okay. So, well, since this is a foundations conference, what's the problem? What are we talking about? What are we interested in foundations? Of course, this is a very subjective and personal take on this, but this is a small list, by far not complete, of conceptual problems of quantum theory. And first of all, states in quantum theory do not assign values to all physical quantities, and we can only make probabilistic predictions. And the interpretation of the formalism needs classical structures. Observers, preparations, measurements, we've seen all this before, and this is, it's not a surprise actually, I think, after the discussion yesterday, that I see them as potential problems. And of course, it's not just me, I mean, it's a long tradition, people have argued that way for a long time. But even if you accept these classical structures somehow, you do not really know how they relate to the actually underlying quantum structures. You have things like the measurement problem. And there's no good logical structure to speak about quantum systems. Quantum logic is very, very weak. So you could say quantum theory does not describe a system in itself. There's no picture of quantum reality arising from the formalism. And you can fill in your favorite from the quantum theory there. But there are more problems, of course. Why is quantum gravity even more problematic? And well, the first thing doesn't really sound like a conceptual point. You can write down the theory of quantum gravity in the sense that we would have predictive theory. It's just extremely hard technically. And this is in itself not a conceptual reason, but it points to the fact that very probably you have to overcome conceptual problems before we make progress with this task of writing down quantum gravity. And this is vastly different from discussing quantum theory. We know quantum theory, it's a very good theory, and it does an amazing job in describing a large range of physical systems, but we just don't have quantum gravity. And fundamentally, space or time, or even some underlying structures from which space and time would emerge or arise, they would become quantum objects in such a theory, whatever this means in detail. What could it possibly mean to speak about measurements of space and time? What are different where and when would such measurements take place? So these are problems that are specific to quantum gravity, and of course all the standard problems of quantum theory are still there. And if we're really honest, we have no good idea what quantum gravity is even supposed to mean. And everybody says it will be radically different. That's really radically different. Maybe it's not even a quantum theory. Maybe it's not a theory of gravity. I mean, the set may be very large, and it's just quantum gravity is just a name for something we don't know. What about quantum cosmology? Well, at first sight, this may be somewhat similar, because we somehow expect like ordinary cosmology arising from general relativity. Such a theory could arise from a simplified version of quantum gravity. So it would be simpler, but this, of course, also means it would be more generic. In the theory of quantum cosmology, you clearly have no external observers. You cannot prepare the universe and then perform a measurement on it. There's no statistics. These notions just don't make sense. And arguably, the theory of quantum cosmology would not be embedded into any classical structure. must be understood out of itself. So this is the bunch of problems which motivate this work, and of course, I have no solution to this problem, I wouldn't claim that. But I'll tell you about the direction of research that we are doing, and keep this as the motivation factor in mind. So the one possible conclusion from all of this is it's probably not a good idea to search for quantization of general relativity using Hilbert space methods. And that's obviously what has been tried most, has been tried for a long time. And arguably, the odd one out seems to be quantum theory and not so much gravity. There are no conferences on the meaning of GR. There are lots of conferences on the meaning of quantum theory.
Oh, that's not true at all. There have been dozens of conferences on the foundation of GR. And the same comment about the Lucien stuff, that the idea that general relativity is unproblematic in century is a mistake.
Yes, I know. I'm basically, yes, I'm saying it in a... How should I say? I'm aware that there are conceptual problems, and of course, it's not as simple as it sounds here.
No, but if I can, maybe the chair can rule this out for discussion later, but I would assert that the conceptual problems of classical general relativity are solved. We know what the observables are. We know what the gauge invariance means. We know anything that you know about a classical mechanical theory.
But most physicists would make similar claims about quantum mechanics and this meeting like this on hand, except to the extent that they're about a quantum computation. So the difference
The claim is the result of a lot of work and a lot of thought. The problems do have a different status. It's worth discussing a great length of conceptual issues in general relativity, but they're resolved in the sense that those quantum mechanics are not.
We do have a space this afternoon for. I think we have a 4:30.
Yes, I think we'll do this again. So let's say a bit more about the afternoon.
Unless it's absolutely urgent. That's
I want to put the speaker. It would be great to start this discussion, actually, and I'm glad that I'm not in particular, with an eye to quantum gravity and quantum cosmology, we need a mathematical formalism that allows us to describe physical systems in themselves, if you like, without the need for external observers and other classical structures. And in other words, we need a framework that allows us to formulate physical theories in a realist way. And of course, also we are by far not the first to say this and to try this. And this clearly is also interesting for quantum theory, long before you actually come to quantum gravity and quantum cosmology. But the big question, of course, is can it be done? There are massive problems with that, and the first problem is just that the Hilbert space formula is very, very rigid. You just cannot take away one part of the formalism and still have a physically valid theory. It's no surprise that there is no Bach space quantum theory or something like this. You need old structure there. And so it's hard to get away from the spaces. And another thing is the Kolb-Schwecker theorem, which arguably is a bit more general than the Hilbert space formalism and tells you that it's a big problem. You cannot assign values to all physical quantities under natural conditions. So, implicitly, I'm saying what I'm trying to show here is that we can do quantum theory with at least very little reference to Hilbert spaces. So, what is an unproblematic theory in this sense? What is a realist theory? Well, the prototype, of course, is classical mechanics. And there we have a situation that pure states form state space, which is black and manifold, and the quantities are real valued functions on the state space, and you have an evaluation sending the state and such a function just to, well, the value that the function has at this point of state space, and this gives the value that the physical quantity A has in this state. So there's no mystery about the interpretation of this. You can look at these images of subsets of the real line. And they represent propositions of this form, this symbolic notation just saying physical quantity A has a value in the, well, as I say, Borel set delta. We usually assume that these functions at A are at least measurable functions. And then you can, of course, ask, because given state S lie in such a set, if that's the case, then well, this proposition about physical quantity A is true in that state, and S does not lie in the set, then it's false. What I want you to see here is there is an interplay between geometrical structure, the state space picture, and the logical structure of theory, which is unilogical, of course. This is made precise by Stone's theorem, which basically says every Boolean algebra shows up as subsets of some logical space. Okay, now we abstract from this, and we want something of the following kind. We want a more general scheme for quantum theory and possibly theories beyond, which has an analog of the state space, which has an analog of the real numbers, and physical quantities should be described as errors between them. So this already points to the fact that these things will be objects in the category of errors between them. Why do I say an analog of an analog of? Well, from the Kohn-Schwecker theorem again, we know that there is no naive state space picture quantum theory, and we cannot assign real values. So take this as a strong hint that we will not get away with anything of the form functions between sets. So the idea is just to go beyond spaces, which are sets, to more general objects in a suitable category. And this will also mean to go beyond logic, because there is this place from kind of structure you use as space, or space-like structure, and then the logic you have. We still want a collection of propositions, representatives, forms some logic structure which we can interpret in a nice way. Particular quantum logic is not a nice way of doing that. But we don't expect necessarily that it will be a Boolean algebra. And all these things suggest use topos theory. So we will reformulate large parts of quantum theory in a suitable topos. And, well, that's 5 years, as you know. Okay, so what kind of beast is a topos? So when the experts know it's an elephant, but... I want to keep this very, very, very simple because I could easily spend the whole 45 minutes just giving the definition, and I doubt it will be much clearer from what I can say now. So, topos show up in many mathematical situations, and I want to concentrate on one particular aspect of them. The idea that a topos, and a particular one is called an elementary topos, is a generalization of the category sets. That's just the category which has sets as objects and functions between them. So this is a big category, a large category, and this actually is the category where we usually do mathematics, which you take sets and you put some structure, like, well, the group is a set with an operation such that, and so the topos generalize the idea that you have sets and functions between them. So the objects in the topos can be seen as generalized sets in a certain sense. I'll say a bit about this in a second. The arrows are something like generalized functions. And what is meant with generalizing? Well, we want to be able to do certain things with the objects in our topos that we also can do with sets. What can you do with sets? If you have two sets, you can form a Cartesian product, you can form a disjoint union, and you can form a set of all functions from one set to the other. And we saw this actually, this is exponentials, I think it was, maybe it was during the tutorial yesterday. Most people who know chemical theory will know this, and the fact just is, by definition, the topos has all the structure which can do the analogous things with the objects in the topos. Just as the topos sets comes equipped with Boolean logic, each topos has an internal logic. And this is a bit different from Boolean logic in general. There are Boolean topoi, and in particular, sets itself is a topos, of course. But in general, it is intuitionistic logic, which means the law of excluded middle does not hold. But interestingly, topoi allow for a well-defined notion of partial truth, and we'll see this, how it applies to our situation. This is something which may ring a bell when you think about quantum theory, where in most situations you cannot just say a given proposition is just true or false. Well, usually it's true with a certain probability. And hope that you can use a particular topos to actually talk about truth values instead of probabilities. How did this come about? Well, in the beginning there was Lavier. And Lavier actually decided to reinvent mathematics to do physics properly, and that's actually true. And that's what he started in the 60s. And what he did is, well, the notion of a topos was defined, at least a certain kind of topos, potency topos. And Lavier generalized even this idea of Grothendieck together with Miles Tinnies in the late 60s. But concerning physics, Lavier was and mostly is interested, today still is, mostly interested in continuum mechanics. And of course, I'm leaving out that there have been other applications of topos theory in physics, but I want to come to quantum theory, and as far as I'm aware, actually, Chris was the first to suggest to use topos theory in foundations of quantum theory. That was 1996. And the first paper on this was on the consistent histories approach. I'll usually give, when I give a year, this is when the paper was in the archive, I sometimes give a reference, which may be a year later. I think it's fair to say that we all look in the archive first. So, 13 years ago, Chris did that. And a very central idea that we are still using today was already in this paper. And it's this idea, and I think this idea is very useful, and it's much more general than what we are doing currently. So if you look at this, this, I think, is one of the main messages. So what's the idea? You take some non-descriptive or non-commutative structure. Could be the algebra of observables, of some quantum system, could be lattice of proposition or projections, some Hilbert space, or some history space. Then you consider its commutative or distributive parts, and importantly, I should have actually made this bold, and the relations. It's not just looking at the abelian parts, it's just about how they lie within each other, how they relate to each other. And we actually see that we can get away by quite simply asking how things lie within each other with some very, very weak relation, but a lot of information is contained in there in the concrete suggestions we'll be using. Okay, then there comes in this ominous word for pre-chief solver. So basically, you do not just look at collection of abelian parts, but you define functors on this. And these functors have values in sets. So you just assign to every abelian part some set. And of course, it's a functor, well, you have to take care of the relations between these abelian parts. These will give you functions between the sets that you assign to them. So that's the idea. Then a pre-sheaf is just a traditional notion coming from algebraic geometry. The experts will know and see this explicitly that pre-sheaves are contravariant functors, which means that, well, if I have an arrow in between the abelian parts, which is, let's say, inclusion, then the arrow between the sets I assign to this will go in the other direction. And there's a reason why contravariant functors are used. We'll see also a very good use of covariant functors towards the end of the talk, which this class's work. Okay. And then, already at this point, this is also what it's just how people talk about this. There's this notion of stages of truth. This is also a bit mysterious at this point, but the idea is that, well, all these abelian, commutative, descriptive parts, they give you one perspective on the quantum system. It's a partial perspective, but it's like one stage of truth. And just like the pre-sheaves relate different sets you assign to the different stages, also the truth values. It's not independent what you see at some stage from what you see at another set. The power actually is in the relations. So how did this go on? Actually, then Chris, Jeremy Butterfield, they collaborated for 3 or 4 years, I'm not quite sure, I read these four papers, which are concerned with the Kolben-Schmeichler theorem, but actually they're concerned with how to get around the Kolben-Schmeichler theorem. So the Kolben-Schmeichler theorem tells you something you can't do. They showed what you can actually do by generalizing to a situation where, well, your logic is not Boolean anymore. Your state space is not a space anymore, but actually a pre-sheaf. And this is actually the guy we will look at. So specifically, this is the point where we may precise what I mean by Abelian paths. So you assume you have a non-Abelian algebra of physical quantity. So this is what you would have from a quantum system. I'm not very specific here. It could be C star, could be for Neumann algebra. The things I'm talking about here work for C star algebras, and some things later on work for Neumann algebras only. But this is actually not the main point, I think. If you look at the Abelian subalgebras and you just partially order them under inclusion of smaller subalgebras to larger ones, and that's a very, very simple structure. Think about it, it's just a power set. But then comes an important idea, actually. And you know that each Abelian is decided by something like a spectrum, a Galton spectrum. This just means an Abelian algebra looks like continuous functions on some nice topological space. And if you look at it, this looks very much like classical physics, where you have a state space and functions there on describing physical quantities. So this spectrum of this Abelian part, V, is nothing but a local state space. That's how you should think about it. Now we know we cannot put these guys together to get one big space. This is the Hausdorff thing. But we can put them together forming pre-sheaf, a functor. That's actually what is done here. We put together all these local spaces, which are nice, and then there's no computational difficulty whatsoever looking at the Abelian part. But of course, it's not enough to look at the Abelian part. We put them all together into one large structure. And this is denoted as sigma, and it's called the spectral pre-sheaf. How's this guy defined? Well, we basically know what we have to do for each Abelian subalgebra, also called context. That's a word I have in the slide somewhere, I think. So this is when physicists talk about context. So this is how we understand what the context is, and it's just an Abelian subalgebra. So you assign the spectrum to each Abelian subalgebra, and then you have to take care of the relations. The relations are just inclusions. So if you have the prime contained in V, then you have to do something. You have to need a function from what you assign to V to what you assign to V prime. And this is this function. And this is as simple and nice as you could wish for. It's well known, of course. It's continuous in the current Galton topology. It's subjective, it's closed and open, so it's a very nice function. It's a very natural thing to do. So what we have to appreciate is actually now we see what it is. Even if you've never heard about this before, you know now what this is. It's a collection of spaces, one space for each of the subalgebra, and a bunch of functions between them. We can have one function whenever one Abelian algebra is contained in the large. The function is here. So that's it. And this pre-sheaf can be seen as the spectrum of a non-Abelian algebra N. And as such, it is a non-commutative space. So what's non-commutative about it? It's not a non-commutative space in the sense of non-commutative geometry, surely not. But the non-commutative character actually is expressed by the fact that this space has no points. Well, there's a notion of what is a point in a pre-sheaf. And this guy turns out to have no points, and technically they're called no relevance. And this fact actually has good physical meaning. This is exactly equivalent to the Kopp-Schreck theorem. This was what Chris and Jeremy observed, almost 10 years ago. So we have something very interesting here. We have the spectral pre-sheaf as an analog of the state space, but this guy lives there's not a set, it lives somewhere else, it lives in the topos. Well, there are other pre-sheaves. So you keep this what's called the base category fixed, so you keep all these different subalgebras, and always look at pre-sheaves all of this. And each pre-sheaf is like a set, and there's a certain notion of natural transformation. But this is basically an arrow between this pre-sheaf. This is like a function between these sets. This sigma is one object in this topos of pre-sheaves. This is the topos associated to a quantum system, because a quantum system which has n as its algebra of quantities. Okay. Why contrarian? Why pre-sheaves? Why not cogrand functors? Only brief on this, we can discuss this a bit more if you like. The idea is if you go from looking from the direction of a larger algebra to a smaller algebra, you have to do some course kind. A larger algebra, you have lots of physical quantities, lots of projections. That's fine, but now you want to take a step to a smaller algebra, and you may not have a relative ones in the algebra upstairs, a larger algebra, so you have to cross them. You have to do this in some systematic way. Actually, well, I introduced a concrete mappings doing this course for me. And why is this interesting? Why is it natural to look in this direction? Fundamentally, it goes back to the Kolben-Schwecker pairs. I don't know if you know this, but the Kolben-Schwecker thing basically says, okay, you have some object B living in some of even sub algebra, it shows up as, say, F, A is some function. I should try to write that way. A lives in some function. But it's also G of C. And C lives somewhere else in another B in some algebra. Now, B shows up both as a function of F, both as a function of A and a function of C. So in this language, it's a coarse grading of both A and C. The interesting thing, of course, is that A and B commute, C and B commute, but these guys don't have to commute. So commutivity is not transitive. That's actually the main point. It would just look upstairs. Well, if I have B here, I do have the large algebras upstairs, but I couldn't get to A in any natural way. I can get from A to B and from C to B. So that's fundamentally the reason. I mean, these Kolben-Schwecker pairs, the Kolben-Schwecker pair would be A and C here. Okay. Now we have something which is like a state space, a species actually. And we know that in classical physics, propositions are represented by subsets of state space. So we expect that something similar happens. We want that sub-objects of this guy, which are nothing but sub-pre-sheaves, represent propositions. And this is actually done, and this is one point where I do not talk about the technicalities. I can do, of course, if there's interest. This is what we call the organization of projections. Why projections? Well, first of all, we have such a proposition, and then why the spectral theorem? Yet a corresponding projection operator. And then this is actually put into this mapping which we call the organization. And this actually gives you a subobject. This is exactly the analog of a Borel subset of state space. But this is what represents a proposition. And importantly, again, the organization takes coarse grain into account. If you have a given projection and you want to relate it to every context, well, usually you will not find it in the context. You have approximated by making it larger. That's actually all that the organization does. And interestingly, one of these sub-objects is representatives of propositions, they form Hating algebra. And Hating algebra is nothing but the algebra, well, the algebraic representation of deterministic logic. So this is where the logical aspect comes in, and there is actually a whole new form of problem logic resulting from this. And Chris and Jeremy talked about this quite a lot 10 years back, and Chris and I developed this in the last 3.5 years. And of course, this is intuitionistic logic. It's very different from standard quantum logic. It's a distributive logic. It has lots of good properties that you do not see in standard quantum logic. We have a reference afterwards. There's another paper in the QPI proceedings from this year where I talk about this a bit more. There's another thing. We want self-adjoint operators or physical quantities to become errors in our algebras. I haven't spoken about yet where they will actually go. I mean, you would expect they go to the real numbers, like in classical physics. But actually, again, from the Kolben-Schwecker theorem, we do not expect that we can assign sharp values to all physical quantities. So, what actually happens is here, we have another pre-sheaf, which is another object in this topos, obviously, and it basically consists of intervals. These intervals may shrink to a point, for example, in a situation where you have, an eigenstate, well, I haven't talked about states yet, but later on, if you have an eigenstate, then actually you'll see that in context actually contains the object A, then this will shrink to a point. This would need a lot more explanation. But the basic idea is that we have something which is called also the organization of self-adjoint operators. I think I should say very clearly at this point that it's mathematically related to the organization of projections, but the output is something quite different. The organization of projections gives you sub-objects representing propositions, but the organization of self-adjoint operators gives you, well, these arrows. And now this formally looks very much like what we had in classical physics. So it is of this form. there's actually some time left, and I can say a bit about states. You already get the idea that in this formulation, quantum theory is structurally very similar to classical physics. But of course, the set is going to another topos and look at objects there. A pure state of a quantum system corresponds to a certain sub-object of the quantum. Well, you would expect that it's something like a point, because in classical physics, a pure state is a point of state space. But I already said this guy here, this hypothetical, has no points of technical sense. So, since this is the case, such a pseudo state, as we call it, must be bigger than a point in a certain sense, but it's minimal with respect to a certain natural condition. And once you have this, you can actually do something very nice. You can use the internal logic of the topos of species that we have, and you can assign truth values to all these propositions. And basically what you get is the following. You have all these abelian subalgebras, and in every abelian subalgebra you have a yes-no question. You get yes or no as answer for every context. The truth value is taking all these yes-no answers together. And as I said before, they are not entirely independent. If you have yes at some subalgebra, you will have yes everywhere down from there. So this is what is called, it's not a single sieve. That's not going. So you get an idea that truth value is something much more complicated than just yes, no, but it's basically given by the structure of the topos. So there's nothing you put in by hand. If this is a sensible generalization of the geometrical aspect, then we are just being delivered the logical aspect. So the choice is in the topos, but not in the logical structure. This is given then by the topos. Actually, if we have this, we have something very nice. How would you emphasize this? How's this truth value assigned? How it was in classical physics, where you said, okay, I have this subset representing the proposition, and I have the state, and I just asked, that's the point representing the state, lying the subset or not. And we're doing exactly the same here. You have this sub-object representing the state, you have a sub-object representing the proposition, and you ask, does it lie in this guy or not? And the answer is yes. The answer can depend on the Boolean algebra you're looking at. In some subalgebras, it will be contained, in others not. But the kind of truth value sum is exactly like in classical physics. Okay, pure states are fine, good, but what about mixed states? I mean, those guys are, of course, interesting, and I'm going to say something about them. And what's in classical physics? Well, classical physics is the case that a general state of the system is a probability measure of state space. So, I keep saying we have something like a state space, so what's happening here? And interestingly, it's very straightforward to write down if you give me an arbitrary state of this algebra. And actually, this is one point that really makes sense to go to phenomena, because we need a result in a second which is not available for these algebras. You see straight away that you get a probability measure of the state space from a given quantum state. I say in an appropriate sense, it's a bit more difficult, but actually it's a very simple thing to write down. And then something very interesting happens. So this is the one direction. The other direction is, if I have a measure, can I get back a state? And somewhat surprising, this actually works. Can you find out strictly what the probability measure on this second piece is? And can show that it determines a unique state of the Fermat algebra we started from. That's actually quite a strong result, because the state is a positive linear function on the whole non-abelian algebra. While this measure, I haven't shown the definition, but this measure knows very, very little about non-connectivity or even linearity. So this is, I was actually surprised that this works, and there's a mass theorem which is used. This is the generalized version of Gleason's theorem, which of course is a strong result. This means that, at least in a certain sense, our formalism is not too commutative, not too boring by looking at the Boolean parts only. We can capture the full state space of the algebra in this formalism. Okay, actually managed to do quite a lot, so that's what we've done today. Here is a list of abstract notions, if you like. here's how they are realized mathematically in classical physics. Here's how they look in quantum theory. You see some question marks. I'll say something on this in a second. And here you see how it looks in this Topos formulation quantum theory that I presented here. And you will, of course, see a strong structural similarity between these two guys, but this looks quite different, actually. Why do I say, well, I don't have this question mark here, but surely Hilbert space is a state space for quantum theory. Well, it's not a state space in the sense that we were talking about, such that it has, well, it's something quite different from the classical state space. Spectre accretion is much closer conceptually to classical state space than Hilbert space. Another question mark is here. This could also become an exclamation mark, actually. Truth values. So, well, some people say probabilities are truth values, but it's not really a logical formalism that we're using in standard quantum. And likewise, well, we call this quantity value object. This basically is a quantity take their values. Of course, if you measure, you get a real number. But before you measure, there's basically nothing you can say about the value of this quantity. Yes, and here's the part on measures. Okay. So, quantum theory is the fact that quantum theory can be reformulated in a suitable topos, I would say, casts some doubt on quite a lot of old dogmas, like there is no state space for quantum theory. Quantum theory is fundamentally probabilistic. We can do an awful lot using just a logical structure. I don't say we can do everything. I'm working on that to see how much we can actually do just using the logic. But definitely, there is a strong logical structure that we can use. You can even regard this as a realist formulation of quantum theory. I could add here quantum theory is a linear theory. The spectral pre-sheaf and its proponents, they are not linear spaces. So all these aspects, of course, are interrelated. And Topos theory delivers us tools to generalize both Boolean logic and set-based mathematics, topology, geometry, and especially here, there are lots of open questions anyway. I should say something about related work. Klaus and his collaborators have done something very nice. They took basically, they took the same base category of the subalgebras of some algebra. They used C-star algebras, and they looked at covariant functors. And the advantage there is that from the external algebra N, you get an internal abelian algebra living in this topos of functors. The trick basically is to forget about all algebraic operations between non-commuting operators and just look at commuting operators. But having an abelian C-star algebra, it has a Galfond spectrum. This even holds in topoi, which of course is an elementary proof, which was done by Anoshevsky and Malvi, and Sitters and Kokor have done more work on this. So this guy has a spectrum. This is what's called a locale, this kind of generalized topological space living in this topos. And as you can imagine, it's closely related to the spectral pre-sheaf, which is looking from the external perspective on the thing. Well, they're not the same. First of all, they live in different topos. It's very nice that an object that's closely related to the spectral pre-sheaf actually is the spectrum in a very technical sense. So I like this a lot. And what they suggest is to use opens in this locale as perceptive propositions. And you get a closely related form of intrinsic quantum logic, of course. And I think it would be very interesting to see where the differences are and to work this out a bit. And I should also mention that Giulio Flori has developed a top of three formulation of the consistent histories formalism, so we come back to maybe the beginning of the story. Chris started in the consistent histories formalism. Okay, and here's some.
You mentioned that the propositions are sub-objects.
Yes.
Do you have any notion of the projection of a sub-object on another one?
The sub-objects do form a Hating algebra, so they form a lattice. So you can form means and joins. So if this is your question, It's a pretty, it's a, the nice thing actually is that this is a distributed lattice, and still the kind of logic we can do using these subsets of propositions makes a lot of sense, which is quite cool. I would have to explain this a bit more, but.
Yeah, I have a slightly philosophical question. What I don't understand is that you sell this as a realist approach to quantum theory, since, as you know, intuitionism is the anti-Platonist philosophy or foundation of mathematics.
And I
don't see the realism in this. I support formalism in most of the ideas, but this I've never been able to grasp why you and Chris actually believe this. And make this one of the main selling points. Is this neorealist or even?
Yes, I didn't have this one, but you usually call it neorealist. I agree that historically intuitionism was attached to anti-Platonist philosophical thinking. I would say by now it's been established in so many, well, let's say, real-world applications, even in computer science, that it has lost this flavor of anti-Platonist tech. And I strongly would say this is one of the main motivations. And I know that you like to see it rather as a realization of Bohr's doctrine of classical concepts. At least that's what you say in the papers, yeah. And this is something I would strongly disagree with, but I think it's a nice philosophical discussion, and maybe it's a good thing to start this in the afternoon. That's it with you.
So I can see that there are three purpose approaches, which of course there's yours, there's classes, and which are completely different because the way you embed the lattices within your subject classifier is completely different. I think you're looking at that in your last day. And then I also the paper in which you construct the Hamming algebra from the quantum logic, so you could look at the chiefs over that. So that would actually be probably a third topos. The fact that you just can come up with like a variety of topos approaches doesn't it sort of show that it's all a little bit ad hoc? Like what you're doing conceptually.
Well,
but you get totally different mathematical objects in each case.
Well, there clearly are strong parallels between what class and we are doing. Of course, it's a different topos. The suboptimal classifier is different. And I agree that this is exactly what I meant when I said it will be interesting to see potential differences. I would say it could be the beginnings of a topos approach, but before I can argue about that, it would have to
I want to emphasize the difference, the fact that you end up with totally different results. And this is actually fits in with operational discussion yesterday. Why would you need operational concepts to guide you towards something which you feel comfortable with, and here it seems to diverge in different possibilities.
It's a bit strong to say it diverges at this point. I mean, also the kind of categories being used and the structures being used, they're also changing in your approach, and it's not the same as 2004.
Yeah.
It's not exactly the same as 2004. But that's not the main point. I think the main point is that there must be some physical input to settle these questions, and this, I can only again point to this. I think that there will be, that this will not be a purely philosophical discussion. This will have physical input. We will just look at what do these structures give us, and there may be a decision at some point that one is better than the other. I don't know. So it's not arbitrary.
Well, do you have your hand up?
So if I understood correctly, you construct a topos for every physical system that's out of the terrible. So is there a sense in which these topos can live in a bigger category and create different systems?
It's one of those things, we are thinking about. Tentatively, yes, we have some ideas. I mean, we have some first ideas how to treat entanglement in this. But it's a bit too early to talk about it. But it's a very good question, of course. Yes, that's true. Classical physics, you get away quite easily because they all live in sets, and so the best thing is they live in the same topos.
Well, I think that's the same question differently. Is the construction of the topos from the Bernoulli algebra, is it a conclusive construction? I think you can define which category you're taking in the first place, but it makes sense.
Yes, it is. Yes. Jeff, that's the last question.
So you were commenting in your little summary how this this formalism gives you a non-probabilistic interpretation of quantum mm-hmm. mechanics. So can you just comment on where probabilities live in this picture? I mean, what, where do they go?
Yeah, and the probabilities live here with the mixed states. I mean, I say mixed states, but actually this holds for an arbitrary state. You can treat an arbitrary state as a measure on the spectral pre-sheaf. And I should have said this, you can calculate expectation values, all the stuff you want to calculate. So the usual probabilistic stuff is contained in these domains. And it's really, I think this is an important step because it really shows that the formalism is not too commutative and it does deliver the probabilistic estimate connects up with that. My hope would be that for pure states, you don't have to go here and we may get away just using this picture and purely from logical aspects, we may get the probabilities. I don't know if it can be done. It's optimistic, but it's, well, I don't know. It definitely can be done here.
Thank you very much again.